Good evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, the war is on. China issues, a trade war that is, China issues its own set of tariffs on U.S. goods. The U.S.-China trade war escalated sharply today as Beijing said it would raise tariffs on $60 billion in American goods, defying warnings from President Trump and sparking a global market sell-off. China's Ministry of Finance said it was increasing levies on goods ranging from liquefied natural gas to frozen spinach and toothpaste in, quote, response to U.S. unilateralism and trade protectionism, end quote. That's China's characterization of the Trump administration's move last Friday to increase tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese imports to 25%. What does this mean going forward in this international game of chicken, since neither seems to be blinking? And are there now tariffs on chicken? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's a fellow at the Independent Institute and director of the Independent Institute Center on Peace and Liberty, Ivan Elin. Ivan, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And we're also joined by Associate Professor of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. Dr. Taheed, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
Mr. Eden, let me start with you. Your sense now on China's response to President Trump's move last Friday to increase tariffs to $200 billion in Chinese imports.
Well, I think it was a moderate response calibrated because it's only on $60 billion versus $200 billion. And also, the tariffs range from, starting out at 5%, whereas the U.S. Hiked from 10 to 25%. So I think the Chinese are trying to have a moderate response so that the crisis doesn't escalate anymore. But Trump seems to want the issue for his base. It's more political rather than economic because, as we all learned in high school, tariffs are not really good for anybody.
Dr. Taheed, the same question to you. President Trump and his administration told us that when the Chinese negotiators arrived here last week, that we were going to get a deal done. And now we seem to be right back with escalating tariffs. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I agree that this is a political as opposed to an economic maneuver. It's very difficult, and it has been, to know what's in President Trump's head as to why he's doing the things that he's doing. There is no economic reason for doing this. I mean, the stated economic reason is that we've got manufacturing that has gone abroad, and the tariffs are going to bring back industry in steel and other industry that's gone abroad as a result of NAFTA. And so NAFTA is the big enemy here that President Trump is ginning up to continue that support from his base.
Dr. Taheed, staying in the TPP, could we have turned to that to resolve a lot of the fighting that we find ourselves dealing with right now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there are the issues of NAFTA and the TPP, which did not get passed in terms of its effect on employment going overseas. And what is incensing Trump's base is that loss of employment, particularly that Rust Belt employment. And so that was something he ran on in 2016, and that's a very important point for his base. Now, he has overpromised what tariffs are going to do in terms of restoring industry. But his base, I don't think, doesn't care. At least someone is speaking out for their jobs.
Mr. Elin, you mentioned at the outset that it's a measured response by China. It also seems to be calibrated, if not calculated, to Dr. Taheed's point about Rust Belt employment, because a lot of the products that are being hit, they seem to be strategically placed on states that are important to Donald Trump.
Yes, I mean, the Chinese have enough political knowledge of the United States to know that they need to punish Trump in the states that he's trying to reap gains from. And, of course, there's a lot of Midwestern and states that have a lot of farmers in it who may be the difference in the vote in Wisconsin, Iowa, you know, Ohio, Michigan, even Pennsylvania. So they're trying to punish those areas so that they'll nullify the political gains that Trump is trying to make. The other stated reason for these tariffs is to get China to open up its market, to quit subsidizing its industries, and to eliminate the requirement which China has that if a American company wants to go into China, they have to, you know, transfer technology, which a lot of companies are sort of reluctant to do. So they're also trying to do that. But I think the main goal is to have an issue. And that's why I think Trump backed away from solving this, because I think he'd rather have the issue
than the solution
to bash, you know, for the election.
He'd rather have the issue than the solution.
Right.
Dr. Tawheed, what about the claim by the president, and it's a repeated claim, that China is paying billions in tariffs to the Treasury, as though the president is using these tariffs as a way of raising money?
Well, you know, I thought about that, and it's almost nothing is too far out when you're thinking about the president. 25% of $200 billion is about $50 billion, which is enough for his wall. So I'm wondering if this is going to be a political, or at least brought up as a political way of paying for the wall. Now, it won't do that, because with these tariffs, that trade number of $200 billion is going to decrease.
What about the more fundamental point that the money collected from the tariffs is paid by consumers on increase in product prices? It's not a check that China writes to the U.S. Treasury.
Exactly. And so that's a bait and switch. I mean, I can certainly see him saying that China is paying for the wall, when in fact consumers are going to pay the higher tariff, which is a tax. And there, you know, the increase in prices for consumers is not going to be offset by any increase in manufacturing here in the United States that might come as a result of those products being more costly. You know, a company, for example, that is manufacturing, has 100 employees that moved out of the country and is in a position to move back, let's say, because the price of socks goes up, so you can start a sock factory in the U.S., well, they'll probably hire 10 robots instead of 100 workers to make those socks. So consumers will have higher prices, and on the other side, the employment of persons to make those products is not going to be a net benefit. So,
Mr. Elon, staying with the sock analogy or the sock example, wouldn't the company more likely move that sock factory to Cambodia before they move the sock factory to New Jersey?
Right, because they could move the sock factory back to New Jersey, and then they could settle the tariff war, and then they would be producing socks at greater cost to them. So yes, they would go down to a less developed country. The other thing here I think that we should really focus on is Trump touts his tax cuts that he had in 2017, but this is actually a tax increase. And he says, as you mentioned, that the Chinese are going to be paying for this, and there may be some cost to the Chinese long term. But in the short term, a family of four, his current tariff, what he just did, is going to cost the average family of four about $800. And if he goes through with this, putting 25% on the rest of Chinese imports, it could cost them $2,300 per year. So it's really costly to a family that is not well off. It's a regressive tax hike, whereas his other tax cut in the long term will benefit mainly the wealthy.
I agree with that. The products that we get from China that are going to be have an increase in price are generally low-cost products that are purchased by the poor. The higher cost products, the type of things that come from Europe, Germany, and so forth, they're not going to be hit by this.
What about this whole idea or the manner in which these so-called negotiations are being handled? Because, Dr. Tawheed, you mentioned, I think it was you that mentioned, or actually both of you mentioned that Trump is playing to his base here. So he's got a political calculation that he's making, and he has to present an image, or he feels that he has to present an image to his base. But President Xi Jinping is dealing with term limits. He's been able to get his political council to do away with term limits. And so if he does not get this deal done, many in opposition to him will say, wait a minute, do we really need to go back to term limits because you're not giving us the deal that you said you were going to give us? Mr. Elin.
Well, I think, you know, he's in a much more secure political position just by the nature that he's probably now president for life than Trump would be. Yes, but there are internal pressures on him. And I think one of the things that the Communist Party has done in China is the communist ideology is pretty much bankrupt. So they've tied the party staying in power to economic growth. And this can slow China's economic growth simply because a major export market has been impeded by these higher barriers to Chinese exports. So this is certainly concerning the Communist Party. However, I think he probably has more leeway to in this fight than Trump does, because I don't think Trump is really going to, you know, a lot of the constituencies here in the United States, the farmers will eventually become, and there a lot of them are Trump supporters. Trump farmers, I'm from the Farm Belt, but most farmers are Republicans. But in this particular case, a lot of them are unhappy. So he's got, and they're in some of the swing states as well electorally. So I think if you're measuring who's stronger and who's not politically, certainly Xi has some political constraints, even by being a dictator, but he has less than Trump, I think.
But I think he also has, that Xi is also in a stronger economic position. You know, as part of their economic development plans, they have the Belt and Road Initiatives, which is to establish, kind of reestablish in a modern sense, the old Silk Road out to other Eastern countries. But it also goes into Europe and it goes into Africa in terms of establishing trade relationships with those countries. Now, some of those countries are potential importers of Chinese products. Some of those countries are providers of raw materials or even investment. And so, you know, since I think 2013, the Chinese have been attempting to establish a network of economic relationships that covers about 65% of the people of the world. They are positioning themselves to be a major competitor to the U.S. And so, if their plans go through, they can substitute their export economy for an internal growth economy and export and import to these other countries that they have relationships with.
Also, in terms of the way that China's government manages its economy is different than the way that the United States manages its economy. And China is in the process of moving, what, half a billion people out of poverty? So there are a number of factors, I think, that President Xi has in his benefit that President Trump does not have. Now, in terms of the immediate impact of what's been announced today, you've got shares in Apple that were down 6% midpoint today. Caterpillar was off 5%. China isn't blinking. And Mr. Elin, do you think that the Trump administration really expected that China wasn't going to take it this far?
Well, I think so. But also, I think Trump has sort of changed gears. And I think he now thinks that, you know, this is going to be an election winner for him. And I think that's very unclear. He gets benefit in some places for putting up the fight among both Democrats and Republicans for putting up a stiff resistance to China. There's a perception in the United States that China has behaved unfairly with some of their subsidies and the way they make U.S. companies transfer technology if they invest in China. And those are perceived as being unfair. So there's a lot of sentiment to stick it to China or at least push back against that. So he gets the benefit from that. But of course, then you have certain constituencies that we've been talking about, like the farmers in those Midwestern states that are hurt. And also, I think to some extent, the general consumer prices go up on stuff that they notice it. And some consumers don't notice, but to the extent that they notice it, that could be a negative election. So I think he's decided that this is an election winner for him, that he for his base. But whether it will be is another story November of next year.
In fact, election winner, Mr. Elon, that takes me right to my last question, and I'll throw this to you both. We just have about a minute for each of you to answer. Dr. Taheed, now that the deal wasn't done and the tariffs are being escalated on both sides, how now do you, not you personally, but how do the sides define win?
Well, unfortunately, on the Democratic side, the corporate Democrats' response has been for 30 or 40 years, free trade, laissez-faire. And if they continue on with that process of laissez-faire, which has created the economic situation for the poor and exacerbated it, that's not a very good response to a Trump tariff or protectionism, even though he may not be doing it in the correct way. He is at least going to be perceived as doing something other than laissez-faire. And so the Democrats, if they only respond to laissez-faire, they're responding to the economics of the 20th century, not the 21st century. And that gives Trump a leg up on the economics. Unfortunately.
Mr. Elon, same question to you. We have just about a minute. How do the sides now, based on where this thing is going, how do they define win?
Well, I think if this trade war is significant and spooks the markets and we have some sort of a worldwide economic downturn, certainly we have some of the same conditions as the last economic downturn. And, you know, we've got low interest rates, so people are going into risky investments, et cetera. And, you know, if you have a triggering event, I'm not saying this would be the entire cause of the whole thing, but if the trade war does ignite something like that, then Trump could be in very bad shape politically, because if the economy goes down, you know, he has like from 40 to 46% is all he's ever been able to get when the economy's been good. So if the economy goes south, I think his support, he'll have no chance at all to win. So we'll have to see if that's something happens. It's a risky strategy for him, I think.
Gentlemen, thank you both. We have with us Mr. Ivan Eland, fellow at the Independent Institute and director of the Independent Institute Center on Peace and Liberty, as well as Dr. Linwood Taheed, associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Gentlemen, thank you both for your time today, for your contribution to the Critical Hour. Look forward to having you all back.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Leon.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, Pompeo to discuss Iran with European leaders today. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo crashed a meeting of European foreign ministers in Brussels today to push for a united transatlantic front against Tehran and its nuclear program. But he failed to bend attitudes among leaders who fear the United States and Iran are inching towards war. The meeting comes amid increased tensions between the U.S. and Iran, and as European leaders look to preserve the Iran nuclear deal. After the Brussels talks, Pompeo will continue to Sochi, Russia, tomorrow. There, he will meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Why is the U.S. continuing to swat at this hornet's nest? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a Washington author and investigative reporter. He is the editor of the Deep State blog, which can be found at www.deepstateblog.org. He writes about the power and influence of secret intelligence agencies in national and international affairs. Jefferson Morley. Jefferson Morley, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me, Wilmer.
So, your thoughts, what's going on here? It seems like Pompeo just shows up on the steps in Brussels and hardly anybody wants to talk to him.
Yeah, I mean, the United States and the European countries had spent years negotiating a deal to delay any military use of Iran's nuclear program. That was an agreement that was torn up by President Bush. And now the Iranians are trying to put pressure on Europe to honor the agreement. At the same time, the Trump administration is stepping up a campaign of leaks and threats to provoke the Iranians into taking some action that would justify war. So we are inching, you know, we are in a, both countries are in a confrontational mode now. The reports that we've heard over the last week about troubling Iranian actions and that sort of thing are wildly overblown. This is very familiar to anybody who went through the run-up to the invasion of Iraq in 2003. The things that the intelligence reports that have been trumpeted on cable news, in fact, when military sources were asked, said these are perfectly routine deployments. So the administration is trying to portray Iran in a negative light to justify what's going on. And this trip is part of that. Europeans are not interested. They're baffled as to why the Trump administration tore up an agreement that was clearly in the U.S. interest. The Joint Chiefs of Staff said it was in the interest. Even Trump's own Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, argued that it was the agreement with Iran was in the interest of the United States. So this rush to war doesn't have any support outside of Washington, certainly not in Europe. So Pompeo is not very welcome, I guess, you know, but it will make headlines and it will create the impression that, you know, the two countries are on the brink of conflict.
Create the impression. I'm glad that you framed it that way, because last week it was Pompeo cancels his trip to Germany. Now, at the last minute, he redirects his flight from Moscow to Brussels. This almost seems like a sense of urgency looking for a problem.
Yeah, really it is. I mean, Iran has a minuscule armed forces. It poses no threat to the United States. Any threat that it poses, we can deter because we could overwhelm them with force. So this is bullying is what it is. It's trying to get the Iranians to take some action that will justify a U.S. and Israeli and Saudi attack on them. And really, that's what's behind all this, Wilmer, is Saudi Arabia and Israel fear Iran because Iran's power has been growing in the region. When we destroyed Saddam Hussein, that was a big favor to Iran. Iran has emerged much stronger in Iraq after our invasion. In Syria, we sided with the losing side. Iran sided with the winning side. So Iran has gained some influence in Syria and Lebanon because they chose intelligently and we chose poorly. So now Saudi Arabia and Israel, looking at Iran's growing threat, want to counter it. What do? They don't want to spend their own money. They don't want to risk their own forces fighting Iran. They want to drag the United States into it and have the United States do the fighting. That's what's going on, a Saudi-Israeli alliance to drag the United States into fighting Iran. We have no beef with Iran. I mean, we have complaints with Iran. We don't like them. We don't like what they do. But they pose zero threat to the United States. And let me tell you something else, Wilmer. How many Americans have been killed by terrorists born in Iran in the 21st century, since January 1st, 2000? How many?
I'd say the answer is zero.
Yeah. I mean, I keep asking people in the Trump administration, can you tell me a time when an American has been killed by an Iranian-born terrorist since 2000? Yeah, the answer is zero. It basically, there is zero threat there. So, and compare that to Saudi-born terrorists attacking Americans or Europeans. The number is in the thousands.
I'd have to say we could start with the Twin Towers coming down.
Yeah, yeah. And then go to Al-Qaeda attacks in Madrid, London, Paris.
not to mention the forces, the armed forces that are being funded by the Saudis that we claim to be battling in Syria and other places.
Exactly, exactly. So this whole thing is very misbegotten. It's very reminiscent of the run up to war in 2003. And you know, when you go to war on propaganda and bad intelligence, not surprisingly, the results are terrible. And we've seen the invasion of Iraq was a fiasco. It cost $1 trillion. It didn't make Americans safer. It killed 5,000 Americans. It killed 1 million Iraqis. And it was completely unnecessary. That's the kind of situation, unfortunately, we are in again today. So
let me jump in here real quick. You mentioned the Iran threat. We hear that term all the time. Can you explain, is the Iran threat a ongoing military action that Iran is engaged in, or is it that Israel and Saudi Arabia just don't like the relationships? And as you said, Iran choosing smartly as it's picking sides in these Middle East conflicts. Does that question make sense?
Yes.
Okay.
The Iran military threat in terms of how many soldiers, how many guns, how many planes, how many missiles, it's infinitesimal. And U.S. is superior, overwhelmingly superior in every regard. There is no military threat from Iran to the United States that cannot be deterred by overwhelming U.S. force. So we don't need to issue threats. We don't need to bully to deter them. This isn't about a real military threat. This is about the political threat, and it's about Israel and Saudi Arabia trying to put down that threat by luring the United States into war.
So it's not a real, practical, tangible threat. It is a philosophical, psychological issue.
Exactly. There is no military threat from Iran. There is none. And there has, like I said, Iranian-backed forces have not attacked Americans in the past 20 years. It has not happened, period. So there is no real threat. There's a hyped-up threat to achieve the political aims of Israel and Saudi Arabia.
If you were to put a percentage on a mistake occurring, the United States has sent the USS Lincoln and a battle group to the region. There were talks.
Those ships are there all the time.
Right.
There's nothing unusual about the movement of those ships.
Lincoln was the time frame for the Lincoln was moved up. It was on its way there, but the time frame for it getting there was moved up. Correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that the odds of a miscalculation are growing. I don't know what to put it on,
okay,
but it's much greater than it was a week ago. I'll put it that way. The threat of a miscalculation by Iranian or American forces to create an incident between the two countries, that threat is growing. And it's growing by the day when we get these irresponsible and unfounded statements from U.S. officials.
And final point, what I would see here is not a miscalculation by the Iranians. What I would see here is the United States misrepresenting an action and using that as the pretext for conflict.
It could be that. It could be that, you know, the Iranians overreact to something and the U.S. gets what it wants. I mean, there's both are possible.
Okay.
The point is the United States is trying to create a situation in which a misunderstanding or a misrepresentation can occur, because based on otherwise, the relations between the two countries would be peaceful.
But see, here's what I say to that. If I create a scenario for a misunderstanding, we're not having a misunderstanding because I created the scenario for it to exist.
Sure.
But we're saying the same thing. Jefferson Morley, editor of the Deep State blog, which you can find at deepstateblog.org. Thank you very much for your analysis. Thank you for your contribution today. And I truly look forward to having you back on the Critical Hour.
Thank you, Wilmer.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. So Gates says Taliban could retake Afghanistan if U.S. withdraws. Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates says the Taliban remains a threat in Afghanistan. On CBS's Face the Nation, Gates, who led the Defense Department during the Obama era, said the Trump administration must be assured of a stable Afghan government before the U.S. withdraws the 12,000 troops that are stationed there. Gates said a premature withdrawal could lead to grave consequences. Well, is he right? And what does this really mean? Well, we turn to my next guest. He is the director of Afghanistan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute, Dr. Marvin G. Weinbaum. Dr. Weinbaum, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you.
So, your thoughts on Gates' comments?
Well, I tend to agree with him. I think that any departure of American forces before there is some kind of settlement, and that's not going to be easy to arrive at, in which the Afghan people can be assured that what would follow would be a true sharing of power, a partnership with the Taliban, rather than a Taliban takeover. Anything which couldn't assure that is likely to lead, in short order, to a government defeat and dominance by the Taliban. So his argument is that without American forces there to keep the Afghans in the game, there really is a likelihood that those forces, the security forces, will succumb to the Taliban.
What is the likelihood that, A, the Taliban would agree to such a power-sharing arrangement, and B, adhere to a power-sharing agreement that is reached?
Well, I think you're exactly right here. There's really only a matter of faith that they would agree to an agreement. And then to get an agreement, I believe, is virtually impossible for this reason. There is an enormous gulf between what the Kabul government stands for and the way in which the Taliban view a future Afghanistan. For them, it is about the restoration of a Sharia state, an emirate, as they call it. And this would entail here the kinds of political institutions which are incompatible with the idea of a popular, democratic, elected parliament, a president chosen by the people. These ideas are incompatible with the Taliban's view about what a true Islamic state is like. So I don't foresee that with all of this discussion that we're ever going to get to a comprehensive, sustainable agreement on which the United States would find then in itself in a position, and not just the United States, but some 14,000 other troops from other countries would find themselves in a position to say, well, now I think things are secure enough that we can leave. So the sad truth is that we probably don't see any light at the end of this tunnel.
And so if there is light, is it an oncoming train? So then what happens to these 12,000 troops? Is the United States in Afghanistan forever? Or does the United States leave, a vacuum is created, and the Taliban regains power? What happens?
Well, you know, interestingly, I don't think the Taliban would regain power if the state failed, if the government failed, and indeed if the state failed, the whole political system. I think that what would follow would be a bloody civil war. This is not comparable to the 1990s, where what you saw was a transfer of power from the Mujahideen government at the time to the Taliban. Now it is a much more complicated situation. The picture does not have two forces, a group of northerners around this Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the leader of this group. By and large, it was cohesive, and a more cohesive Taliban around Mullah Omar. That kind of confrontation would not take place this time. Both of those are far more divided among within themselves, not to mention the differences between them. So I think that a whole model here that government failure leads to Taliban restoration is itself a faulty notion.
You mentioned the Kabul government, which is U.S.-backed.
Well, it's U.N.-backed. It's Western-backed, certainly. And after all, other countries in the region recognize that government as well. All of the countries in the region, indeed, recognize that government. And I would say that none of them want to see a restoration of a Taliban-led emirate. On the other hand, they also don't want to see the United States there indefinitely. And that's a kind of quandary that we're in here. I think that most of the neighbors worry about the United States having strategic interests in the region which go beyond Afghanistan. But at the same time, they don't want to see a collapse because that would leave a vacuum in which then the civil war that I'm talking about would flourish.
We'll leave it there. Dr. Marvin Weinbaum, Director of Afghanistan and Pakistan Studies at the Middle East Institute. As always, thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour. I look forward to having you back.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Venezuela's Guaido officially requests U.S. military support in a letter published today. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido has formally requested the support of U.S. military forces in the ongoing political and humanitarian crisis, a letter published by his representative, Carlos Vecchio, was out today. Well, what's going on and what's going on the ground right now in Venezuela? And how is all of this being interpreted and received? For insight, we turn to my next guest. She's with the campaign to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela, Terry Matson. Terry, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Oh, it's great to be back.
So in his letter, Guaido says, "We welcome strategic and operational planning so that we may fulfill our constitutional obligation to the Venezuelan people in order to alleviate their suffering and restore their democracy," Vecchio said in a letter to Admiral Craig Fowler, commander of the Southcom, United States Southern Command, in a letter dated the 11th of May. It was published on Twitter today, Monday the 13th. He also requested a meeting between Southcom and, quote, the appropriate members, end quote, of Guaido's inner circle. How's that playing out right now on the ground in Venezuela?
Well, you know, where I am, it's just another eye-rolling experience. People just, I think we talked about that, the same description as to the April 30th, the day of the quote-unquote attempted coup. You know, it's really quite unbelievable, and I think maybe getting bigger play in the United States than it is here. People here are not are used to the opposition, or this particular, I really have to say this particular segment of the opposition behaving this way. And the letter is, you know, reading the letter, it's very cleverly crafted. It does not overtly ask the Southcom for military intervention. They're asking for a meeting. They're asking for help in resolving the problems. I don't know why you would write the Southern Command if you weren't, you know, asking in a backhanded way, at least for military intervention. But it's not getting much play here. And, you know, you and I have talked before that where I'm living, I've been here for 2 months now, I'm living in a working class community, Barrio Colonia district in Caracas. It's working class and it's politically mixed. You know, varying degrees of Chavistas, varying degrees of opposition. We do not have any of that super wealthy, hard right, white opposition in the neighborhood I'm living in. And so people really see this as a specific segment of society wanting to control the resources here, the human resources and the natural resources. That's really how people are starting to more overtly explain it.
I'm glad that you explained it and defined it the way that you did, because a couple of things that I found interesting about the letter. First of all, it was written to Admiral Craig Fowler, not President Trump.
Exactly. And not written to Pompeo.
Not written to Secretary of State, not written to the president. Also, he says, we welcome strategic and operational planning so that we may fulfill our constitutional obligation. Well, as I understand it, the court in Venezuela is not siding with Juan Guaido. So his constitutional obligation referenced to me has already been dismissed by the court.
Exactly. Exactly. But, you know, the letter, I believe the letter, I'm not looking at it, but I read it multiple times today. The letter is written on embassy, the letterhead, I think.
Yes.
It says the embassy of the, well, yeah. It doesn't say, you know, the it's not the foreign ministry of Venezuela. It is very curious that Vecchio is supposedly Guaido's Venezuelan ambassador to the United States. Why would the letter not be written ambassador to State Department? You know, mm-hmm. Foreign ministry to foreign ministry. It's not. And as you said, it's not even written to the president of the United States. It's written directly to the Southern Command. And that's very disturbing and very telling. And, you know, Fowler, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, several weeks ago, or maybe even a month ago now, you know, said that the Southern Command is ready if the U.S. Orders it to,
yes,
do whatever I believe he has said that.
Yes, he has.
So did that comment of his a month or so ago leave the door open for Vecchio and Guaido to write him direct? It's very, very unusual. I mean, he is just working directly with the U.S. military. I don't even know how to. I mean, that's just unprecedented.
I find it interesting. He's requested a meeting between Southcom and the appropriate members of Guaido's inner circle. So first of all, he's not asking for a meeting between Admiral Fowler and Guaido. And again, he's requesting a meeting with Southcom. I would still think that that request would have to be approved by Pompeo, if not the president.
Or the United States Congress.
I forgot about them.
Yeah. And those men and women sitting in the House of Representatives. I mean, it's outrageous. It's unprecedented. It's really, and again, you know, it's almost, you wonder if it's some sort of publicity stunt, some sort of attention grabbing threat. It's really hard to understand what it is.
That was also when you were talking about where you're living, and you've talked and very clearly before about the segregation in the country in terms of, I think, the eastern part of Caracas is where the wealthy live. I was wondering if this was just really written and published for consumption by Guaido supporters.
Perhaps. Yeah, perhaps a propaganda piece, a media piece, whatever you want for them. Yeah, a rallying piece for them, perhaps. You know, I think it's also, you know, it's important to understand, though, yes, the east side of the city is wealthy and is where, you know, the majority, the predominant Guaido supporters live. But, you know, there's also Chavistas that live on that part of the city. So just because you have money or own a private business doesn't necessarily mean you're anti-Chavista or anti-Maduro. Mm-hmm. You know, the commune, I think this is one of the things people do not understand in the States is that many, many communities are politically mixed and they are not at each other's throats, you know, trying to promote a civil war. It's very, you know, people are living just fine among themselves with differences of political opinion. You have extremes that are, you know, really causing the propaganda. You have extremes. But you know, there are opposition people, and I'm not supporting the opposition, but there are opposition people that you actually can talk to, you know, that they're reasonable. They're not calling for intervention. They're not calling for a civil war. They're calling for peace.
What are they calling? What is within those reasonable opposition supporters that you are engaging in dialogue with? What are they in opposition to?
They are, they don't particularly care for the economic structure in the country. They're more small business, private business. Mm-hmm. They lean more that way. And I would suggest probably always have, although I haven't known this particular community that long. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they don't want intervention. They're not looking for a civil war. They're perfectly capable of talking with people of different political perspectives. And I think that's really important for people back home to know that there is not a united block of opposition people supporting Guaido. It's much more, you know,
nuanced.
Sophisticated. Yeah, much more nuanced. And yes, that's a good word. And much more sophisticated.
So really, really, civil war, if you're a small business owner, civil war is bad for business unless you're in the bullets and gun business. Civil war is going to be bad for everybody.
Of course it is. Of course. And, you know, I the other day I called home yesterday for Mother's Day. And I was on the phone with my mom and she heard I was sitting outside our front door talking, and she could hear all these children playing in the background. Mm-hmm. And she asked me what that was. And I said, oh, you know, it's the kids playing. Well, what do you mean? You know, right. All the neighborhood kids that live here of different political oriented families are out in the street playing. They're walking their dogs. They're kicking the soccer ball around. They're screaming and yelling and chasing each other. And it's all very normal and wonderful to see. It is not, you know, this is not a situation that's on the brink of a civil war. And she's not the only one that has heard kids playing in the background when I've been on the phone. And I will say everyone responds the same way. It's like, what's that noise? What do you mean the kids are out freely playing in the street? Well, yeah, they are. And families allow their kids to play with families of different political views. And with the news today, you know, there was just a lot of eye rolling, like, oh my gosh, you know, another stunt, another what are they up to now type thing.
So I'm glad that you gave that description because I was going to ask you to give us an idea of what's on what's the sentiment right now. And that your description reminds me of the last time we spoke to Ricardo Vaz, and he was talking about, well, it's lunchtime. I'm going to go down to the government building. There's a big music festival going on right now. And I said, wait a minute, your country's in the midst of a coup. And I said, what kind of coup is this? But is there any sense that this is the calm before the storm? Or are people kind of still looking out of the corner of their eye, wondering when the next move is going to be made?
I think that, you know, I can only speak to you from my personal experience in this particular community. You know, I can't I can't speak for other, communities in other parts of the country. And that, I think that's an important thing for your listeners to understand,
mm-hmm.
you know,
there, yeah.
But no, I mean, there just simply is just, you know, everybody got up this morning and went to work and went to school, you know, the cars all started up at 7 a.m. and people went off mm-hmm. to work and the kids all walked to go to school. And it was just normal, you know, like Ricardo was sharing with I remember you and I were speaking, that you've invited me on, but we were talking on May 1st and you had said, so what's it like to be in Caracas on day two of the coup? And I said, well, I'm not even sure there was a day one of the coup. I mean, there was like a 3-hour coup attempt, basically, sorta, you know, and I think that's kind of how this is as well. And I think it's very, very poor leadership and poor PR to show the Guaido people directly communicating, you know, with the Southern Command. That again is just the letter doesn't overtly call for intervention. That kind of communication is just so unorthodox and just shows what they're still pushing for. They're still pushing for intervention. And that's a fine thing to do when you're sitting on U.S. soil and you're not here in Venezuela. You know, it's interesting that you can, you know, you call for this when it's not you and your family that are going to be sitting at the, you know, other end of the weapons.
It's interesting that you say that, because my next point or question was going to be about the conflicts that are taking place in front of the Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. And so there really seems to be a lot more strife and a lot more conflict outside of the country right now than there is in country.
Well, based on what I'm seeing, yes. And it would be very interesting if somebody in the media, yourself perhaps, could do a demographic survey of who those anti-Maduro, anti-government protesters, I don't know if they're all pro-Guaido or not. You know, it seems that they are from where I sit, you know, outside the country looking in at the media coverage, what little media coverage there actually is of the Venezuelan embassy right now. I mean, the New York Times isn't even covering the story as far as I can tell. I mean, this is an unprecedented diplomatic event. I mean, I think in my lifetime, the only other thing I've seen remotely similar to this was the taking of the U.S. embassy in Tehran in the fall of 1979. And mm-hmm. we were all pretty upset about that in the United States, but somehow now that the U.S. through a proxy is trying to take the Venezuelan embassy in Georgetown, it's really, I think we've talked about this before, you know, that all embassies are sovereign territory of
right.
the countries they're representing. You know, the opposition with the help of the U.S., they take that embassy, that will be the coup.
Right.
It's not going to be here. It will be there.
Right, right, right. Got you.
I don't know that many citizens in the U.S. are understanding that or equating what that activity could potentially result in. But it would be very interesting to me to understand that the makeup of these opposition, quote unquote, people in front of the embassy, their behavior, their, you know, the verbiage they use mm-hmm. and their behavior is very exemplary, you know, really shows you who they are.
They might just come from Renacu. Rena protester.
Those SOS Venezuela people, like the SOS Nicaragua people, they might. I mean, you know, I don't. But some of them I saw. I'm not sure whose video it was. Maybe I want to say maybe Project Gray Zone, but I'm not sure.
I was going to say Max Blumenthal, probably.
Maybe. Was interviewing some of the people, opposition people, as to whether or not they supported military intervention, and the majority of them said yes. And I was watching that going, my God, how easy for you to say that while you're standing in Georgetown. What if they were here? Would they still be saying that?
Probably not.
I would hope not.
Real quick, because we got to get out. How is it in terms of getting food and other supplies? Has any of that pressure been relieved?
Here in yes. Venezuela or, yes. in the embassy?
No, I know the answer. I know what's going on in the embassy. But in terms of Venezuela, has any of that pressure in terms of grocery stores and availability of foodstuffs and other supplies, has any of that been relieved?
Well, okay, I would say, okay, I just have to say, you know, you already know this, that, you know, the tactics being used against the embassy collective in Georgetown are exactly the same. Shut off the electricity, shut off the water, and blockade the food. I mean, it's the same, right?
Right.
Do it to a country, do it to their embassy.
Got it.
It's pretty fascinating to watch it. Okay, so I will tell you.
We got about 30 seconds.
It's better. It's better than my experience here last year.
Okay.
I'm seeing more products produced domestically, although not enough volume, but more, a better diversity of products produced domestically and more of them.
Okay.
And that includes food products, protein-based, you know, eggs and chicken and clothing and personal hygiene, soap, shampoo, seeing more things produced here than last year.
Terry Madsen, I got to stop you there. Campaign to end U.S. and Canadian sanctions against Venezuela. As always, thank you for your contribution to the Critical Hour and look forward to having you back. All right, folks, you've been listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened, and I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.